Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play. That'll give you access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents, and there are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. You'll have access to incredible shows only available on Gaia, like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and Deep Space. Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, your Roku, your Apple TV, and Amazon Fire. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. Gaia.com/expanded perspectives. That's all one word, folks. Gaia.com/expanded perspectives. Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is brought to you by Casper Beds. Casper Beds Cam is an amazing product. This mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups, you know, like everybody knows about. But Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. Now, recently, me and Cam both got queen-size Casper beds sent to us, and it was really cool. I didn't even know how it was going to get here. So when I got home and I saw the box on the porch, I was like, wait a minute, something's wrong. There's no way a queen-size bed fit into that thing. But when you open up the box, it's like, the only way I can describe it is like vacuum sealed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you cut that plastic bag, it expands right before your eyes.
Yeah.
And it's truly the life size of an actual queen-size bed. I can't believe they shipped it like that.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about quality for a second. Casper used an in-house team of engineers that spent thousands of hours developing these amazing beds.
Mm-hmm.
And it combines supportive memory foam for a sleep surface that's just got the right sink and just the right amount of bounce. What I'm talking about is, if you don't have one of these new age beds like a Tempur-Pedic or a Casper or what's the one you have, Tufton Needle mm-hmm. or Ghost, what's so great about these foam beds is if your partner, whoever's in the bed with you, gets up in the middle of the night, you don't even feel it.
Yeah.
I mean, you could literally set like a glass of wine on the other side of the bed and probably jump up and down the bed. It probably wouldn't even turn over.
You're right. You probably
would. Love that because I know that I wake my wife up multiple times, whether it's snoring or getting up to use the bathroom or whatever
right?
it is,
yeah.
because I think aliens are coming in the room, so I have to get up and look around, get my flashlight out. But you don't ever do that. And these foam beds are also very breathable, and it's because of that design, it keeps you cool while you sleep,
mm-hmm.
and it regulates your temper throughout the night. Casper mattresses are very convenient. Now, when you buy one of these mattresses, it's completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns with, get this, a 100-night home trial. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. And because they use high-quality, resilient foams, they're able to compress these mattresses into these tiny boxes like I talked about and allows them conveniently ship these things halfway across the country for the cost of what it would cost to probably ship it 8 blocks in New York. It's designed and developed in the United States, and they just don't make mattresses. They also make pillows and soft, breathable sheets.
Yes.
I love it. Now, Cam, before he got his Casper mattress, actually tried a competitor.
Yep, I did.
And without any jokes, you said that you actually think you like the Casper better.
I'm on the fence, or I was on the fence. My wife is the one that's just full-blown Casper.
She does?
Yeah, it was over. I mean, like I did, like you said, I bought a Tufton Needle. I bought it because it was talking about how firm it was, and I wanted a good, firm mattress, right?
Right.
Well, I was like, well, what if this Casper, you know, I've seen some people maybe say it's a little too soft, and I don't want to go down that route. Well, I was wrong, 100% wrong. I'm one of those deals. I wish I would have done the 100-night thing. That's what I'm going to tell everybody. If you're on the fence about it, do the 100-night deal. Look, if you're not happy with it, they'll take care of you.
That's right.
And they'll take care of it. We got it in, and I slept on it. I mean, we put it in the spare bedroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
I slept on it. My daughter spent the night on it a few nights. My son. And my son is real picky about the whole thing. And he was staying, he called me a couple of times, and he's like, Dad, this thing's unbelievable. So, yeah, it's one of those, now I've had to switch it. So I've had to take it from the spare bedroom into our bedroom
right.
and move our other one out. So, yeah, it's the family mattress. Yeah, that's
and
the, my
and it's now. Affordable. I mean, I bought a Tempur-Pedic bed about 7 years ago. I think I spent close to $6,000 on
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
this thing is a fraction of that.
Yeah.
And I think it's just about as good.
And we can get you even a better discount on it.
That's right. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/expanded. EXPANDED. And when you get over there, use the promo code EXPANDED. Terms and conditions apply. Let's start the show.
What is going on out there, everybody? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. Me, Cam Hell, doing my, I guess that was some sort of strip club voice I had going on again when we got it fired up. But I'm not in here just by myself. Y'all know that. We're going to have a little fun, but sitting across from me, yeah, that's the man over there, the great beast himself, Kyle Filio Filson. What's going on, Rudd?
Man, I'm doing good, except for the cold front that came through and the tornadoes.
Right? What's going on? Yeah, first of all, real quick, thank you to everybody that sent messages. Beth, everybody that sent us messages and whatnot. We appreciate it. Yeah, we survived. It was one of those deals that hit up in Canton a little ways from us over there in East Texas. They were some swirling winds bouncing around here and whatnot. But yeah, so we're good. Apparently, three tornadoes tore through Canton, last I heard, and it was, you know, it took a few lives. So, yeah, it's springtime in Texas, so we're used to that. This is something, sadly, that you get used to.
Yep.
So, you know it's coming, and, you know, we could see. But it was real weird yesterday, you know, with the way the cold front worked. We'll discuss more of that crazy cold front stuff in the outro when we get into that, because I've got some things I need to talk to y'all about, folks. We're going to jump right into this. I've got a news story that I have to bring up because it involves Dallas-Fort Worth. Yeah, that's right. You heard me. This comes from The Verge. This was actually written back on April 25th by Andrew Hawkins. Yeah, no relation to the Hawkins I know. But it says Uber is getting serious about building real, honest-to-God flying taxis.
Really?
Yeah, really. And, of course, in this wind, I was thinking about how much fun that wouldn't be. It says this. When Uber first announced its crazy-sounding plan to explore this on-demand urban aviation, which sounds amazing. Basically, that's what it's going to be. It's a network of flying taxis that you can contact through the smartphone app, and it'll be flown from rooftop to rooftop. So companies will add helipads, basically, to the top of every one of their buildings,
right,
and you'll bounce around like that. But it said that the company made it clear that they never intended to go at this alone. Now, earlier this week, there was a three-day Evaluate conference in Dallas, Texas. And this is what happened. The Ride Hail Company announced a whole gaggle of new partnerships with cities, aviation manufacturers, real estate, and electric charging companies. All of this was done in an effort to bring the dream of this flying car a little bit closer to reality. It's teaming up with governments of Dallas and Fort Worth and Dubai to bring its flying taxis to those cities first, Philly.
Why did we get so lucky?
I do not know.
Must have been that Mark Cuban.
Yeah. Hillwood Properties in Dallas and Fort Worth, They've been joined forces. It's a real estate firm, a rather large one over there. And it's going to identify sites where it will build takeoff and landing pads, which are going to be called vertiports. That's what Uber's calling them, a vertiport. It also signed contracts, or it's in the midst of contract negotiations, also with 5 aircraft manufacturers to work on the design and production of this lightweight, electrically powered, vertical takeoff and landing. So basically, it's electric VTOLs is what they're going to be building.
Now, are they going to be piloted by people, or are they going to be autonomous?
Well, I'm assuming, now, when I was looking at that, I'm assuming that that's what they're probably pushing for, given the fact that it's they're wanting to get it where they can demonstrate it by 2020, okay?
Okay.
That's what they're pushing for. So in 3 years, I would imagine they're going to have it piloted at first by people that can fly it.
So it's going to be like a little helicopter.
Exactly. That's what it's going to be. But I'm sure that they're going to be pushing into trying to get more autonomous stuff. But I would imagine that it's going to start out as people, like we said, working for them. Because it's probably something you're going to have to be skilled in flying, I'm going to guess. Which means autonomy would probably be the best way to do it.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And the safest way to do it. And the cheapest way to do it. You know what I'm saying? You wouldn't have to hire all these people. And and here's the thing that I can't find in the article, and I really would like to know, and it's one of those things, I guess I ought to email Uber or whatnot, is what would there be a difference in insurance as far as, you know, you're going to have to insure this.
Right.
Because I'm assuming that when you ride in an Uber now, you're insured through the driver's already insurance. If Uber is already partnering up to do this, this isn't an individual that owns this thing that's going to fly it themselves. This is going to be Uber flying this thing, right?
Right.
So what would be the insurance? Would it be cheaper to actually have a pilot, or would it be cheaper, you know, because due to human error? Because what basically the picture that they were showing, that Bell Helicopters working on this, it's a concept vehicle called the FCX-001. If you look at it, it looks like it'll hold about 8 people. In double rows is what they're talking about. Okay. That's kind of the way this thing looks is what I'm looking
right,
at.
Yeah.
It's rather large. So it's not like a compact flying vehicle. It's a rather large, almost, you know, like a small group of bus or something. Like we wanted to go parties. You know, what do you do? You're going to hire the Uber. I mean, and you're just going to get power drunk and just bar hop from rooftop to rooftop. I would think that it would need to be autonomous simply because of everything it has to do.
But just to clarify, is it a car that has a rotor on the top of it like a helicopter and then it lands and then drives? Or is it simply just a helicopter?
It's a VTOL.
And they're just calling it, you know, I mean, it's just an Uber, but it's a flying Uber.
The reason they're saying they're calling it a flying Uber is because they're working with all these other companies to build those vertical pads on all of these businesses, and they're just going to be small aircraft that just hop from building to building to building, from Dallas to Fort Worth, you know, I'm sure up to Denton, things like that, as they bounce around in that whole DFW Metroplex. So if you had to commute to work, wouldn't that be the best thing? Like if you lived in Fort Worth, you had to drive to a little commuter station, instead of taking a bus or a tram, you just jumped in that and run over there like it?
Yeah, I guess.
I would think it would be pretty awesome.
Now, I've personally never used Uber. Mm-hmm. I know lots of my friends that do. I just don't go that many places, so there's really no need. But I can see this as a cool way to travel.
Yeah, I've never used Uber myself. My niece, that is the flight attendant up in Chicago, uses Uber often.
Uh-huh.
You know, and she Ubers a lot, so she's like an Uber veteran. I would have to see what she thought about this whole thing, because she also, like I said, is a flight attendant, so she could probably kind of give me some ideas of what the heck's going on this whole deal. But I do know for a fact that out of all the stuff we've covered, they want to make it autonomous, and I would think that that would be the way that you would actually go, to have a fleet of autonomous vehicles all working together and with your app, and it would be kind of like...
Well, I know Uber's using the autonomous cars up in Pittsburgh and stuff, so
this is coming. We're going to end up having flying cars over there, bro.
Man, speaking of flying things, check this out. This comes from Open Minds, and this was posted by Roger Marsh the other day about a triangle UFO that was seen hovering low over rural Pennsylvania. The article talks about how a Pennsylvania witness at Lancaster County... Always makes me think of Lancaster Archery. Reported watching a nearly 100-foot-long, triangle-shaped object hovering at treetop level. Now, the witness was driving along back roads between 8 and 8:30 p.m. on Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017, when the incident began. The viewer said, "I was at a stoplight when something caught my eye. I glanced over and noticed a line of bright lights. I didn't think much of it and looked away. I took a double look, however, and when I looked back, they were in a triangle formation. Now, I was unsure of what the object was. I went through everything in my head. It was not a plane. There were no blinking lights. Plus, it was too low in the field to be an airplane. I thought it might be a drone. But with being so low, it wouldn't have been a very, very big drone. Nothing was blinking or illuminating off of it. There were no beams or anything like that. Then the object began to move. After I saw it, it moved again. Not lightning fast, but quickly to a third point in the field and hovered again for a few seconds. At this point, I realized the light had turned green and I began to drive away, but interested in trying to figure out what I saw. I looked back and slowed down and I found nothing there. Nothing in the sky. There was nothing up higher. There's nothing in the field. It was totally gone. There was one very bright light at the top and three, maybe four dimmer lights coming out of it in a triangle formation. Now, that's pretty bizarre, but very similar to several other triangle sightings, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. The only thing I can say about it, I believe this person saw something. When they start talking about actual size, like it was 100 feet long, I always question, like, how do they know that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When you see an object floating or hovering in the sky without something to scale it to, it's really hard to determine how big something is. I mean, maybe it was a drone just really close up, so it looked larger than it was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but with very interesting.
With an open background like that, that's the toughest thing.
It seems to be the sightings of these triangles are becoming more and more prevalent.
I still think it's all ours. I think we're just now, like we've discussed in the past and on the Elite Show, I think it's one of those things that we're just now getting to where it's something that we're going to, in a few years, we'll probably find out that was ours, and then it'll be another, it'll be forgotten about, and then there'll be a whole nother flood or wave of UFO sightings or something, of some other strange thing, and then 20 years later, we'll find out that was ours.
Right,
and
it'll be just hourglass shaped or something like that. Yeah.
Something even crazier. Speaking of something even crazier, I did a little digging around. Had to go deep, deep into the dark web to find this. This comes from the website cryptozoologynews.com, folks. Woman says she saw a Bigfoot in North Carolina.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was not Micah Hanks of the Grayling Report. It wasn't Micah. It wasn't Micah this
was
time.
Was it Matt Oakley?
Wasn't Matt. Maybe it was Caleb, but it wasn't that. So this actually happened, folks, back in the late 80s, back in the summer of the late 80s. There was a 47-year-old woman named Tracy Hibberts, and she told Cryptozoology News that at the time she was at a restaurant near a wooded area when she spotted the hominid. Now, this all took place in Gaston County. She said, I was going to smoke a cigarette before my family came out of the restaurant where we were eating at. So the restaurant had a deck on the side of it that went out over the water where you could feed turtles and ducks. Now, she goes on to say that the restaurant was out in a very rural area and that she was the only one to see what she called a Sasquatch. She said, I was alone and I walked down to the water quietly. And as I approached the deck, I saw it bent down to the water. I did not know what it was until it saw me. She goes on to say that it kind of stood up and then it made a fast run across the watered area back there and then in plain daylight. And she said in an instant, this thing was completely gone. Now, she also recalls this, that it had brownish dark color and that she said she was not able to see its face because it was running so fast. She said, I only saw its bent over body and back and it was fast like nothing I've ever seen. Now, she said when she told her husband that he dismissed it as a deer, but she brought this point up. Deer do not run on two legs.
No, they don't.
No, they don't, no matter how much you train them. Now, it goes on in this article to talk about back in the summer of 2016, there was a couple of men in North Carolina said they saw the two Bigfoot creatures back in Guilford County. And then a few months earlier in Rinalo, North Carolina, they also talked about there was a primate with red fur, but those children saw it. And they talked about it being a 10-foot tall one.
Man.
So there's a bunch of course, you see how heavily wooded and mountainous areas up in North Carolina, there's a good chance, you know. And we've talked about it, and, you know, me and right out in this very studio, we've sat here having a lot of wobbly pops with Mr. Hanks, and we've discussed a lot of that going on in that area. So it's one of those things, this area, I could be like, yeah, you know, if it's is. But what would you, like we always say, what would you mistake that for?
I have no idea.
It's not like a dude in a coat just jumped up
They always say, well, it could be a guy in a costume. Yeah. But I still stand by that, man, you are putting your life in your own hands if you're going to be walking around the woods in a monkey suit.
You're exactly right. And this is the summer. This is in the summer, the late summer of the 80s. I can't imagine it being real cool and airish in North Carolina. So you're going to run around in a monkey suit in the summer to try to fool a woman that's only going to see you for 30, 45 seconds? Come on now.
I'd like to say it was possibly a black bear, but who knows?
Yeah, that's true.
You never know.
That's right.
Speaking of cryptozoology, check this out. This comes over from Mysterious Universe by Paul Seaburn. It's about a shape-shifting creature that was reportedly captured in Ghana.
Oh.
Cam, you're going to like this. This strange story comes from the Nigerian website, NAIJ.com. Now, I did not go there because I refused to click on any Nigerian websites.
You don't want to try to save some money and have it be, all you got to do is give them your account number, your bank account, and somebody died's going to leave you like $4 million. We're set. Go ahead.
Right.
I put your bank account in one of them already.
Anyways, this story was allegedly confirmed by Sika Bursa, who's a member of the National Service Personnel in the Volta region of Ghana. Now, he said that residents of the Kitu South municipality of the Volta region had reported that their pigs, cows, and chickens, as well as some other livestock, were being mysteriously killed by something that eats the intestines and internal organs, but leaves the rest of the carcass. Sounds like a wild dog or a scavenging animal, except witnesses claimed that it was a human that changed into a pig and chased them before disappearing.
Whoa. It changed into a pig?
That's right.
Wow.
Last week, a hunter claimed to have seen the creature shift from human to animal. Now, there's no description of what kind of animal. And he shot it, Cam.
Oh, so we got one.
Which caused the creature to unfold wings and fly away. It was soon seen in a nearby village of Afif, where a farmer claimed it attacked him. Fortunately, the farmer recited a magic incantation, and the creature reverted back to human form, but wouldn't leave his farm. He called for help, and his neighbors convinced a young boy to go in with some magic herbs and catch the creature. This seems to be where the police arrived, and after seeing the creature, Cam, get this, change from half-human, half-duck into a small human. They captured it and took pictures for social media. The alleged shapeshifter in the pictures looks like a young boy or a small man, and no one seems to be afraid of him. Unfortunately, the report ends without any indication as to the fate of the boy, man, shapeshifter. Is the whole thing a hoax? That's what many are asking. Or is this another case of humans fearing or blaming someone who's different? And that may be the case. But they says that there are stories in Ghana told by the Ashanti people of the Sasabonasam or Asabonasam, which, get this, Cam, is a giant bat-like cryptid with the head of a fox, iron teeth, and iron hooks on its feet, and wings that are used to carry away humans.
An Asabonasam.
Yeah, it's sometimes described as tall, thin, bearded, blood-sucking human.
Whoa!
With red eyes and feet that point in both directions.
Ooh, use a fine uh-huh. I want you back that Asabonasam up.
Right. Now, Ewe people of Ghana tell tales of the Adzi, which is also a vampire-like cryptid that eats organs.
Dude, we got to look into some sightings of this thing. This thing sounds like Mecha Godzilla. Mecha Asabonasam coming in.
I've never heard of these stories, and I'm going to have to. I'm with you. I need to get into some African cryptids.
That sounds.
But come on, man. The story.
Iron teeth.
Listen,
I like turning into a baby duck.
Half human, half duck. They say the guy read a magic spell and he turned into a human and they took pictures. Cam, the pictures just looks like a small man. I mean, how am I supposed to believe that?
Somebody Snapchat you some pictures of half man, half duck.
No. All the pictures are only human form. And they even go on to talk about...
The camera wouldn't pick up the duck form? Oh, man.
They said when asked, all the locals say, look, you can't take a picture of a shapeshifter in any form other than human form. They won't allow it. I'm like, well, that's really convenient.
Right? Drats.
Anyways, I thought you would like that story. Well, let's take a break, folks. And after the break, I'm going to be talking about some real life human demonic possessions. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. We'll be right back. The very word exorcism stirs controversial feelings and conjures upsetting images for the average person. America's first famous exorcism actually occurred in the early 20th century. Its details were not made available to the public until the mid-1930s, and the female victim was anonymous up to a point. Today, little thought is given to her, but Emma Schmidt would forever be immortalized in the classic horror novel and film, The Exorcist. Humankind, since pre-recorded history, has availed itself of exorcism in one way or another. Exorcism, at its most basic, means ridding an afflicted person, place, or object of evil spirits. This ridding of bad spirits is found in the ancient cultures of Native Americans, the Jews of antiquity, Stone Age Malaysians, and even the early Christians. It is a global phenomenon born of ignorance and superstition. The afflicted, often diagnosed with evil spirit possession, may merely be mentally ill or emotionally distressed. The image of the shaman dancing around a possessed person, shaking rattles and blowing smoke into the victim's face, may seem quaint and dated. Shadows of such practices, however, remain in every religious cleansing ritual still practiced today, such as baptisms, christenings, ritualistic bathing, the New Age practice of smudging, and many more. These are all symbolic gestures intended to keep evil spirits away or to drive them out from a potential sinner. These primitive exorcisms, or those done by street preachers or TV evangelists, are not what spring to mind for most people when the word exorcism is uttered. Public perception of exorcism is more directed by the real exorcists, the elite core of Vatican clergy, whose grueling job it is to drive out demons or evil spirits, many times Satan himself, from a person harboring such evil. Whether or not the lay person believes in exorcism is irrelevant. The sufferer believes in it, and that's all that matters. The palliative effect of such a highly ritualized event as exorcism, sanctioned by none other than the mighty Catholic Church, is very powerful for those weak in mind and spirit. To the Catholic Church's credit, these days, it examines claims of demonic possession with great skepticism. It only authorizes exorcism after all other reasonable remedies, such as medical or psychiatric treatments, have been explored and abandoned. To prove just how rarely a real exorcist is ever called into service, the exorcism of Emma Schmidt in Earling, Iowa, in 1928, was not only America's first famous exorcism, it was one of the last in America, officially sanctioned by the Catholic Church. Born in 1882, near the town of Earling, Iowa, Emma was raised in a devoutly Catholic family, but had always been known as a charming and cheerful girl until she reached the age of 14, after which she began to display very unusual behavior and signs of potential possession. The first symptom was an aversion to anything religious in nature. The once pious girl began to go into fits when confronted with the Bible, holy water, or any holy imagery. She showed an inability to enter a church. She also started to blurt out incredibly, deeply obscene things, detailing depraved, unspeakable sexual acts she could not have been possibly even known about, as well as the insatiable, unhealthy interest in sex. She then demonstrated detailed knowledge of Latin and German, two languages she had never had any exposure to. By 1908, Emma seemed to be totally under the dark spell of whatever evil entity was invading her, and it came to light later that, far from the deeply Catholic citizen they claimed to be, Emma's father and aunt were in fact secretly practitioners of witchcraft who had supposedly cursed the girl at an early age through spells and special herbs sprinkled into her food. The advice of medical and psychiatric professionals was sought, but no one could find anything wrong with her, nor any reason for her outbursts. After years of this, religious counsel was requested And so would begin the first exorcism of Emma Schmidt in 1912, during which a Father Theophilus Reisinger was able to successfully cast the demon or demons out, but this proved to only be temporary. It is claimed that the estranged father and aunt worked their dark magic to call the ejected spirits back, and back they came. They came with a vengeance. Over the next few decades, Emma's turmoil and troubles would return with even more intensity and vigor than they had ever had before. And in 1928, at the age of 46, Emma, whose life had basically been destroyed by unshakable evil presences, turned to Father Reisinger once again in desperation. This time, Reisinger enlisted help, unsure of whether he alone possessed the ability to drive out the obviously very powerful and tenacious demons. He went to his friend, Father F. Joseph Steiger, to beg him to join him in his confrontation with the forces of evil, to which Steiger grudgingly accepted. And on August 17, 1928, the proceedings began. From the beginning of this second exorcism, Emma was immediately repulsed by holy water and crosses and absolutely refused to eat blessed food, which she could supposedly detect even without being told. She would often curl up in the corner to purr or hiss like a cat, or to deftly climb up the walls like a spider until she was forcibly restrained to the bed and tied up. As soon as the exorcism began, Emma is said to have gone unconscious and to have levitated, to stick up against the ceiling with so much force that it took several people to pull her back down. Even though the woman seemed to be totally in a comatose state, voices, wails, growls, and screams were said to bellow out from her, even in the absence of any movements from her mouth. She also purportedly vomited forth rancid liquid, spat constantly, and clawed or bit at anyone who came close to her. At the same time, her body began to change in appearance. Her eyes bulged inhumanely from her face, her head and lips swelling up to incredible proportions, and her abdomen was claimed to distend to the point where it seemed it would explode, only to revert to its normal size again to start the whole horrific cycle anew. At times, her body was said to inexplicably increase in mass until the iron frame of the bed groaned under the weight. In addition to this, Emma displayed other signs of classic demonic possession, such as superhuman strength, speaking in foreign languages she could not have known, or moving things with her mind. Over the course of the exorcism, which would last for 3 sessions, spread out across 23 days, it became apparent that Emma was possessed by at least 4 distinct, powerful entities, as well as a horde of lesser spirits. One of the prominent entities introduced itself as Beelzebub, also called Lord of the Flies, and one of the 7 princes of hell, who was claimed to try and engage the exorcists in complex philosophical debates and mind games. Another was supposedly Judas Iscariot, the very one who betrayed Jesus Christ and who was said to have been trying to convince Emma to commit suicide so that her soul would be transported to hell. The last 2 main spirits were Emma's very own father and aunt, who had died since the first exorcism and seemingly had vengeance on their mind. During the exorcism, the spirits apparently predicted a car accident that Father Steiger would be in and relentlessly taunted and insulted those present. And there were said to be swarms of flies that would suddenly cloud the air out of nowhere. So intense was this exorcism that the utterly terrified priests and nuns involved refused to stay for long in Emma's presence, instead working in shifts. Father Theophilus was the one who spent the most time in the presence of evil, steadfastly determined to rid the woman of these strange forces, and over time, he wore the spirits down, eventually succeeding in driving them out, after which Emma is said to have jerked awake and praised Jesus. Father Steiger would go on to write his own account of the bizarre and terrifying events in a 1936 pamphlet titled, "Begone, Satan," a soul-stirring account of diabolical possession in Iowa, which was meant to act as a sort of guide for priests in identifying the signs of demonic possession. Then, there are cases that seem to come straight from Hollywood. Or, is it vice versa? One terrifying story involves the Perrone family of Rhode Island. The family moved into an old 18th century house, hoping for a fresh start in the country. But soon things took a wrong turn. After a few nights in the house, the mother, Carolyn, began seeing the ghost of a woman that had hung herself from the bedroom ceiling. Over the next couple of days, strange disembodied sounds could be heard throughout the house. Doors would open and close by themselves, and the family would often be woken up by the invisible hands pulling them out of bed. Things got worse when Carolyn began to act strange, speak in a demonic-sounding voice, and displayed inhuman strength. The Perrones decided to enlist the help of paranormal investigators, who discovered that the house had a grim history. It had belonged to a witch, who sometime in the 18th century had sacrificed her child to Satan and then hung herself as part of a strange ritual. Not only that, but the house had been home to a series of suicides and grisly crimes, the ghost of which seemed to hang around to the day. The paranormal investigators unsuccessfully attempted to exorcise the demons out of Carolyn, but were unable to. The movie The Conjuring is loosely based on the family's horrific experiences in this house. There are other cases, and not just in America. In 1906, Clara Germana Seeley, a South African girl, began displaying signs of demonic possession. She exhibited superhuman strength and could throw nuns around the room by motioning to them. She was known to make inhuman noises, speak in tongues, as well as speak languages she had no knowledge of, including French, German, and Polish. A two-day exorcism eventually forced the demon out of her body, with Clara attempting to strangle the priest, performing the ritual several times. According to witnesses, it wasn't unusual during the exorcism for Clara to levitate several feet in the air, only being brought down to her bed when sprinkled with holy water. In the late 1700s, locals of the village of Yatton, around 20 miles from Bristol in England, were rather alarmed when a man by the name of George Lukens began to display increasingly bizarre behavior. He would spontaneously start snarling like an animal or barking like a dog, as well as singing hymns backwards. Sing or chant in a foreign language that the illiterate man did not know, speak in both the voice of a man and a woman, or blurt out vulgar obscenities or profanity for no apparent reason. During these fits, he was also said to often convulse, walk around on all fours, or appear to be thrown about by unseen hands. It was all very uncharacteristic behavior for the young man, who villagers had known to have always been a well-behaved, calm, and cheerful fella. These weird episodes were completely unpredictable. They could last for up to an hour and plagued Lukens for years, forcing his family to have to put him in a mental institution for 20 months, where all efforts to treat him, or indeed find any cause for condition, failed. Indeed, these episodes became even more intense and tinged with the paranormal as time went on. Lukens would have violent outbursts where he would claw or bite at people or smash items with strength far beyond what his slight figure would suggest, as well as speak in voices that were not his own. And he also showed a profound aversion to religious symbols, objects, or even words. Now, spooked villagers began to suspect Lukens was under the influence of some sort of demonic force or witchcraft, and even he himself began to proclaim to anyone who would listen that he was possessed by seven distinct demons. Now, one minister by the name of Joan Valton had long known Lukens and said of him at a time, "I personally knew him, a youth about 18, short in stature and meager in aspect. He had frequent fits or paroxysms and was sometimes affected like the Pythonises, or rather like the Furies, mentioned often by Herodotus and ancient writers. He was cruelly distorted and uttered foul language, but was often heard to say that he should be delivered if seven ministers should pray with him." Whatever was tormenting Lukens was obviously taking a toll on his health. He had wasted away into an emaciated, withered-looking husk of his former self, drained of all vigor, and villagers became extremely worried about him. The story of the odd, seemingly possessed man spread through the village and the surrounding areas, finally coming to the attention of an Anglican reverend in Bristol by the name of Joseph Esterbrook. When the other clergymen of the church were told of the case, most of them agreed it to be a possibly genuine demonic possession, but refused to get involved, perhaps out of fear. Nevertheless, Esterbrook managed to gather together six other ministers from a movement of Protestant Christians called Wesleyanism for the purpose of arranging an exorcism for the demon-plagued Lukens to be held at a temple church on June 13, 1788. The whole thing was meant to be a low-key affair that would be kept secret, so this ragtag group of exorcists was no doubt very surprised when hundreds of gawkers arrived out of morbid curiosity, fueled by the stories on Lukens that had been circulating by both word of mouth and through the local news. According to Esterbrook's own account of the ordeal, the exorcism started with Lukens eerily singing in a high-pitched voice, which soon dropped in timbre to a deep, gruff one that ridiculed and berated the ministers present and told them that they would undoubtedly fail. He then started alternating between a man's voice and a woman's voice, spewing out vitriol, blasphemous rants, threats of physical violence, and even at one point jarringly singing a love song. The demons also made it clear that they were infuriated with these priests, would want to try to exorcise them, and expressed contempt towards Lukens for telling them of their evil presence within him. As this triad went on, other distinct voices began popping through, chattering about different things, singing, barking, growling, babbling about utter nonsense, and one particular bass voice bragging about his vast powers. Sometimes the voices spoke perfect Latin, which Lukens had had absolutely no knowledge of. Surprisingly, one skeptical observer who was trained in Latin and convincing him that perhaps what he was seeing was all real. Lukens also sang out a hymn of praise called a Te Deum to the devil, proclaiming him the supreme leader and governor of all things. The haunted man became so unruly that it required two men to hold him down as the ministers said their prayers over his writhing, contorting body. When asked why they were torturing Lukens, one of the demons allegedly replied, "So that I may show my power among men." After 2 hours of intense prayer and constant physical restraint, Lukens then became calm, praised God, and stated that the evil presences were gone. In the aftermath of intense exorcism, controversy stormed around the event and Lukens' veracity, while those who had been present were convinced that this had been a genuine demonic possession, and many upstanding citizens of the village also tended to agree. Others were not so sure. There were those who criticized the truthfulness of Lukens, claiming that he was well known as a clever ventriloquist and a skilled mimic, as well as an alcoholic and prankster. Others said that Lukens merely suffered from some form of epilepsy, which had been exaggerated by the clergy to seem more supernatural, or that the demonic possession part was wholly fabricated by Lukens to avoid having to work. Even some other clergy criticized for exorcism itself, accusing the Wesleyan ministers of not having been properly ordained to engage in such battles. All things told, the Lukens exorcism turned out to be one of the most hotly debated and controversial exorcisms the country had ever seen. For his part, Lukens experienced no further incidents of demonic possession and returned to a quiet, humble life. Although he wanted to stay in Bristol, He eventually returned home to Yatton due to negative public reaction to him living there in the wake of the exorcism. He would go on to live a rather poor life with only sporadic employment as a bookseller and bill sticker, and living mostly off begging and the government aid until he died a lonely man in 1805. Which brings me to this question. What about when someone commits a horrible crime and blames it on the devil? Is he or she really to blame? Or is there something sinister really in control, forcing their hand, making them perform terrible acts that they normally would never do on their own? This strange tale begins in the quiet, affluent, and peaceful neighborhood of Brookfield, Connecticut, where an unassuming family, the Glatzels, had arrived in order to clean and put in order a rental property they had recently acquired in the scenic town of 13,000. Shortly after they arrived, a series of bizarre events began to unfurl that would mark the beginning of a madness that was about to spiral out of control. One day, about a month after they had arrived, Miss Judy Glatzel reported that her youngest son, 11-year-old David, had suddenly and inexplicably fallen down rather forcefully onto the bed, as if he'd been shoved. When questioned about the occurrence later, David told his mother that he had in fact been pushed by what he described as an old man with a burnt-looking skin who had a pointed finger, and he pointed it at him and growled the word, "Beware," before finally throwing him onto the bed. At first, the Glatzels wrote it off as an overactive imagination of a young boy, but David had always been a very honest boy, and his situation would get progressively worse. He began to wake up at all hours of the night, sobbing uncontrollably, and when asked what had happened, he would describe how he was being visited in the darkness by an old man with soulless black eyes, animalistic features, sharp jagged teeth, pointed ears, and hooves. David claimed that the intimidating entity was continuously warning him that if they moved into the rental house, they would be harmed. David said that sometimes the apparition would snarl in some foreign language or threaten to steal his soul. The spooky visitations also began to be accompanied by various unexplained phenomena throughout the house, such as inexplicable footsteps, slamming doors, and disembodied voices. David began to exhibit strange wounds, such as scratches, cuts, and bruises on his body for no discernible reason, and his night terrors gradually worsened to the point that he would wake up howling in terror practically every night. The alarmed Glatzels took notice and became convinced that this was not a simple case of their kid trying to get out of household chores or school. They enlisted the assistance of a local Catholic priest from St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Church in Brookfield for guidance. The priest performed a ritual cleansing of the house, but it seemed to have no effect as the ominous phenomenon continued. The increasingly desperate Glatzel family pleaded with the church for help and referred to two demonologists and exorcists by the name of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with Ed and Lorraine. The Warrens' arrival seemed to mark an increase in bizarre events and aberrant behavior on the part of David. The Warrens came to the conclusion that there was a malevolent presence in the house and that David was most likely subject to multiple possessions. It was around this time that the Glatzels' 26-year-old daughter, Deborah, implored her fiancé, a man named Arne Johnson, to move in with them in order to make them feel safer. In light of what they saw as demonic possession, the Warrens went about conducting a series of exorcisms in an effort to rid the boy of whatever malignant entities were still residing within him. Three exorcisms, involving the help of no fewer than four Catholic priests, were conducted, during which time David would growl, snarl, curse, spit, kick, and scratch like a madman, all to no ultimate effect. The Warrens also claimed that during the exorcisms, David would cease breathing for long periods of time, contort his body into unnatural positions normally not possible, and even levitate. The normally quiet and peaceful boy was also said to start talking of murder and stabbings, which further alarmed both the family and the Warrens. Eventually, the exorcist learned that there were 43 demons supposedly residing within David, and when they asked him who was there during one of his episodes, the boy gave 43 different names. Now, Debbie's fiancé, Arn Johnson, was becoming exhausted by the whole ordeal and started taunting the demons that were tormenting David. He is said to have shouted at them on several occasions and to have challenged and commanded them to enter him instead. Johnson was reported to have repeatedly said on numerous occasions, "Come into me! Leave the little lad alone!" During one of these times, he became terrified when he claimed to have seen the demons and even made eye contact with them as he looked into David's eyes, something the Warrens had strictly warned him not to ever do. Not long after this, Johnson crashed his car into a tree, and while he was unharmed in the accident, he would later claim that the demons had taken control of him and caused him to crash. In November of 1980, Judy and Carl Glatzel took their son to a psychiatrist to see if there was anything that could be done to help the increasingly disturbed boy, or if any answers for his condition could be gleaned from the scientific community. The psychiatrist informed the family that David was normal, exhibiting only a minor learning disability, certainly nothing to account for his escalating bizarre behavior. Nevertheless, they enrolled their son in a special school for disturbed children, hoping that this would somehow cure him after all else had failed. In the meantime, Debbie and Johnson moved out of the house to live in an apartment near the Brookfield Pet Motel, where Debbie had gotten a job as a dog groomer. The manager and owner of the pet motel, as well as the landlord of the apartment, was a man named Alan Bono, and who would become friends with the couple. In the ensuing weeks, Debbie Glatzel became increasingly concerned as Johnson started to display a strange, uncharacteristic behavior. The normally polite and even-tempered Johnson would become highly irritated at the smallest things and would suddenly go into bizarre trances during which he would growl, snarl, or convulse, and which he had claimed to have no memory of. During several of these episodes, he would shout out in despair that he could see the beast staring at him, after which he would once again claim that he could not remember such a thing happening. These weird trances became more frequent and his behavior more erratic, until Debbie started to fear that perhaps her fiancé had been possessed by the same demons that had been inhabiting her brother, despite the fact that none of Johnson's co-workers reported anything out of the ordinary. On February 16, 1981, tragedy struck. Johnson called in sick to his job as a tree surgeon and joined Debbie and Bono for a lunch party, during which they all reportedly drank heavily. After the party, they returned to the apartment to hang out, and at some point during the conversation, Johnson and Bono got into a heated argument. During the confrontation, Johnson allegedly went into one of his trances, after which he started growling like an animal and pulled out a folding 5-inch knife and proceeded to viciously and repeatedly stab Bono, who would later die at the hospital from his wounds several hours later. Johnson, who had no previous criminal record of any kind, had fled the scene and was apprehended several miles from the scene of the crime and charged with first-degree murder. He claimed at the time that he could not remember anything of the incident. The case was already exceptional, as it was the first murder ever recorded in the history of Brookfield, but things would take a turn for the bizarre rather quickly. A mere day after the murder, Lorraine Warren made the claim that Johnson had been possessed by the demons when the murder was committed, and that David Glatzel had said he had seen the demons go from him into Johnson's body. This was further given fuel when the family supported these claims, saying that the murder had been the devil's work and that the beast had transferred to Johnson's body during the exorcisms when he had taunted them to do so. When Johnson's trial finally came, his defense attorney, Martin Minella, decided to use the alleged demonic possession as an actual legal defense for his client. It would be the first time in the United States history in which the defense sought to prove innocence by arguing demonic possession and therefore a lack of personal responsibility. The trial commenced on October 28, 1981, at Connecticut's Superior Court in Danbury. As expected, Minella entered a plea of innocence on the grounds that his client had been possessed by demons that had passed into him from David, and as such, had not been in control of himself, therefore releasing him from any responsibility or of any wrongdoing. During the proceedings, alleged taped evidence of the priest confirming approval for an exorcism was presented, as well as lurid photographs depicting scenes such as Johnson kneeling over David on the floor with a crucifix pressed into his forehead, and another in which Johnson is holding the boy down as the crucifix lies broken on the floor next to him. Despite this, presiding Judge Robert Callahan was not convinced, and he disallowed this argument, stating that none of it could be objectively or scientifically verified through the available evidence, and as a result, all of the testimony related to the demon possession defense was thrown out. The jury not permitted to consider it as a viable reason for the murder, and Minella was forced to change his tactic, changing his stance to that of self-defense. Well, after 3 days of deliberations, the jury came to the conclusion that Johnson was guilty of first-degree manslaughter, and he was sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison, of which he would ultimately serve only 5. So what do you think? Did the devil, in fact, really make Johnson do it? Is it possible for demons to take control of a human being and then use them as some sort of spiritual conduit, a drone-like puppet, under their complete control to carry out horrible crimes against humanity? There seems to be some evidence that some dark force can compel a rational person to commit evil deeds that they would never imagine committing otherwise. But more importantly, if this does occur, can the person truly be held accountable for it? Whether these horrible acts are the results of mental illness, a simple act of rage, or demonic possession, one thing is crystal clear. If you do ever encounter someone who appears to be possessed, do not call them out or challenge them in any way, or you might find yourself in some very serious trouble. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. With Expanded Perspectives. I love the stories of demonic possession. They're terrifying, and I almost get scared sometimes when I'm late at night up, you know, researching and everyone's asleep and it's dark out, and here I am reading about demons. I'm like, man, I might be bringing this on myself.
You shouldn't do that, dude.
But also think it's pretty silly that the guy's lawyer actually tried to get him off of a murder case because he claimed that he was possessed by a demon. I mean, even if he was, how are you going to prove that?
Dude.
And that's exactly why the judge got rid of it. They're like, look, man, there's no way to prove that that actually happened.
That is a good lawyer, though, to try to pull anything out of his butt. You know what I mean? Just to try it.
Yeah.
That's a good lawyer.
What do you think about demon possession? Like the
exorcism things? I try not to.
You know, but,
well, okay. I'm going to get into this.
I mean, you're familiar with.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've done, you know, we've covered some possessions, and we've talked about some creepy stuff and all that. And we laugh and joke about it, you know, as far as like, oh, don't look at it. It's going to look back. And all this stuff, and whether or not you want to believe that there's a God or there's not a God, or there's a devil or there's not, whether or not you can't deny the fact that there's evil in this world. And if there's light, there has to be dark. So we already know there's a sun and then there's darkness. So we know the sun goes up. So it's there. We know that this balance, this yin and yang, is there. So if you have somebody that's shining, and I've said this before, really bright on one end, it has to be really dark on the other. So that balance is the way it is in this universe. I have a feeling, a sneaking suspicion, that somehow these things manifest themselves in people. Why some of these vessels are easier taken over than others, I don't know. But I just, because I think it goes back into us talking about these dark areas. Like when you go and visit area and go, look, I just had a heavy feeling. I think that heavy feeling is that darkness, is that evil, is that foreboding still there? And I think some people, like we've always talked about, I'm not an empath. I don't have that ability to pick up on that stuff. Jen DeVillier, the friend of ours, Jen, she does. I mean, we know a bunch of men and women both and listeners of this show that can do these things. I am blind to it like a mole. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just like, it looks dangerous to me. Let's walk over. You know, I don't feel right. that. So I think it's the people that feel it more and are more in tune with it are the ones that are more in danger of this stuff going on. It's almost like I'm like a broken TV set, you know, like you can plug me in, but I'm not going to bring up a picture. It's kind of one of those type deals.
Right, right.
But I do feel that there's something to it. Now, I don't know if it's some of the stories you hear kind of sound like, it's just somebody crazy trying to get away with something, much like what we've discussed. And then some of the others, you're like, dude, that's some darkness right there that's just not natural.
It creeps me out.
Yeah.
I don't like to think about it. And I definitely don't want to mess with it. I would never call out a demon like the one guy did and challenge it. That's just something you don't want to fool with.
No, why?
It's not just Christianity. These cultures from all over the world throughout time believe in these spirits and demonic forces, and they always tell you, you know, tread lightly. You know, don't mess with them.
Yeah, why would you even do that? Why would you go out of your way to do just that? No thanks.
Right, I would never invite anything like that. That's the same reason I don't go ghost hunting. I don't want that stuff following me home. Exactly. I don't want anything to do with it.
Exactly.
Speaking of things that are terrible, you signed yourself up for a disc golf tournament this weekend. How did it go?
Well,
and I don't mean you're terrible, but the wind and the conditions.
I was terrible too, so you can go ahead and say, yeah. I bit off a little more than I could chew. That's putting it lightly. Yes, folks. As we started recording this, I have literally been off the course less than an hour. Winds are between 45 and 55 miles an hour today. We had gusts that some were saying were exceeding 60 miles an hour where we were playing in a rolling hilled area up here in North Texas. And yeah, there was that. I've been playing disc golf now for about 60 days. I think I've played a total number of courses, like a total number of times played, were like 12 ever. And this was for a good friend of ours that Kyle and I went to school with, put together a thing for his church. It's for a Cambodian mission trip that his church does, and it helps to raise money. So I was like, look, I'll come play it.
Yeah.
I had signed up for it online a while back. I had no idea the weather was going to be like this. I didn't pay attention. You know that. Surprisingly enough, people, I don't pay a lot of attention to stuff like that. So I know y'all aren't shocked. So I get up this morning and I'm like, oh, this isn't going to be good. And then sure enough, when I got over there, it wasn't. So for everybody I know that likes to play disc golf and whatnot, all the people that have reached back out to us and have asked me some questions and things like that, you want to know what I shot? We shot 20 holes. We played 20 holes today.
Now, not to stop you, but I've never played. Does a disc golf course have 18 holes?
Like yeah, it's 18. It's just like regular golf. Okay. Yeah. Every hole was a par 3 today. Okay. Real tough. There was a few of them probably should have been par 4s, but everybody complains. You know how that goes. But this one had some bonus holes, so we played 20 holes of golf today. I'm not afraid to tell y'all, I shot 26 over par, dude. I was 26 big. Normally, I can shoot about 10 up at the course here in town.
Oh, because of the wind.
10 over. So, yeah, and dude, I started out terrible. So, I started out at 24 over. Now, I've cut it down to 10 over. Not today. So, I'm like, look, I'm getting the dead-ass last place. I hope they give out something for the worst score. I got it. Wrong. I was better than like 7 of them.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, there was other. Now, even. There was a playoff because two dudes shot even today.
That's awesome.
It was unbelievable. One of the guys in my group ended up getting fourth place, and he's the guy that me and Kyle have grown up with. So this dude was on fire today. Not old Cam here. Old Cam was dragging the anvil around today.
Well, don't feel bad. I've never played disc golf before, but when I play regular golf, I'm probably consistently 26 over par.
Yeah, right?
And that's just the way it goes.
Well, they told me I did a good job. They're like, hey, look, man, it's a tough course. I'm like, hey, look, you say whatever you want to. I didn't lose a disc. I'm happy.
Did you have fun?
Dude, I had a blast.
Did you get some exercise?
Oh, I got a bunch.
Did you get to look at some birds?
I got to have a great time.
There you go.
You know what I got? I got a free shirt. Well, I say free. I forgot what it was to even sign up. $30 maybe. I got a shirt, a bad, awesome shirt. I got a koozie. I got a barbecue lunch. And then I got to walk around with all my buddies and play disc golf and laugh. Win-win.
Yeah, sounds like a good day to me.
Then I came back here, pound it right here. We got to hang out here with my bud. We're going to do a podcast. Dude, I had a great day. My day was awesome. Now I got to ask you, how was the bruds? How was everything going this weekend with the baseball game?
The baseball game was amazing. We played a good friend of mine has another team We went to high school together, everything. And he's got a team, same age as my boy. Mm-hmm. And this, we're talking about like 11 and 12-year-olds. And we had a game today. They're the Padres. We're the Rangers. We took a lead. We had them. They caught us. And then the game remained tied 4-4. And we went into extra innings. We went into like three extra innings before finally we gave it up. Some kid hit a walk-off. Not a home run, but a walk-off run. And we actually lost by one. But I will say it was a very good game, very close game. It was a defensive battle. Our pitcher did awesome. I mean, I think he had 12 strikeouts. Ooh. I mean, and their pitcher did pretty well. I will say this. The kid that hit the walk-off run, my friend told me, that kid hasn't had a hit all year long. So if I'm going to give it up to a kid, I'd like to give it up to him because ecstatic. He was jumping around. He was doing cartwheels. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, you lost. It was a good game. You're disappointed that you lost. But, hey, this is Little League Baseball.
You're right.
I'm glad the kid had a good time. And this probably be a day he'll remember for the rest of his life.
You're right.
You know what I mean?
You're 100%. That's awesome. Yeah.
So it was a good time. We had a good time. The season's almost over. But then, of course, we'll start summer and travel ball this summer. So school's almost out. So the brood are really excited about that. But outside of that, man, I just hung out. My sister-in-law and brother-in-law had a birthday, mm-hmm. so we kind of went and hung out with them and, you know, had snacks and stuff. And then last night, of course, I was watching the Stanley Cup again, which I'm going to be doing tonight. So.
I did a wedding. I actually got to marry a good friend of ours' daughter that I've known since she was real small. Her and my son and my nephew, you know, they've all been friends of the family. So she got married this weekend. I got to conduct the wedding. And even talking about that, I will be in Las Vegas. I believe it's May 19th through May 23rd because I'm doing a wedding up there again. So I'm going to go up there and do another wedding. Now, get a load of this. I have to be registered in Las Vegas to do a wedding in the state of Nevada.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But how crazy. I'm like, so you can go up there and get married in a drive-through, but I can't come up there and conduct a wedding in your state without being registered for them. Like, man, come on, dude. I can get married by like some guy dressed up like Elvis. But anyway, so no
well, if anyone's going to be in the Las Vegas area during those days, hit Cam up. Maybe you guys can meet up for a drink or something.
Holla at your boy, because I'm going to be up there. So holla at your boy. Fire us a message on Facebook or something, or email us or whatnot. ExpandedPerspectives@yahoo.com. Y'all know the drill. Just fire it off.
That's right. And before we get out of here, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Gaia. You know what Gaia is? Gaia is a video streaming service just like Netflix or Hulu. They have 7,000 titles over there, all things you're interested in. If you like Expanded Perspectives and you like the topics we cover, you're going to like Gaia. They have shows over there, one-of-a-kind shows that you can only find on Gaia. Shows like Beyond Belief with George Norrie, Cosmic Disclosure with Corey Good and David Wilcock, Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howe, Buzzsaw, my favorite Deep Space, and much more. Much more. You need to go over there, folks. They have three different plans you can choose from: a 3-month plan, a monthly plan, and an annual plan. If you sign up for the monthly plan, your first month is only 99 cents, and after that it's $9.95. It is awesome. If you want to go over there and sign up, go to gaia.com/expandedperspectives, all one word. That's gaia.com/expandedperspectives. And Casper Mattresses. Casper makes incredibly comfortable and affordable beds here in the United States. And when you order a bed from them, they ship it in a small box with some kind of crazy futuristic giant vacuum sealer. And Casper offers free delivery and free returns with a 100-night home trial. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Give $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/expanded. And use the promo code EXPANDED, not Expanded Perspectives, just the word EXPANDED. That's Casper, CASPER.com/EXPANDED. And Mother's Day is approaching. Don't forget about Bloom That. Get beautiful fresh flowers hand-cut when you order them for maximum freshness. Order today and a premium designer vase or vase, depending on where you live, that cost everyone else about $15, and a handmade caramel treat that normally costs $10. You'll get both those absolutely free. Just go to bloomthat.com/expand. That's bloomthat.com/expand. And don't forget, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting Expanded Perspectives. If you have a story of your own you'd like to share, you can email the story expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. And if you can't get enough of Expanded Perspectives, don't forget we have another service, Expanded Perspectives Elite.
Now, by signing up for Elite, you'll get an additional show every Friday, as well as access to our entire back catalog. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com, click on the Elite tab, and signing up is easy. It's only $5 a month, and Mary can help you out with that. Cam, what do you got planned for this week?
Man, oh man, just hard work and clean living, baby. You know me. Probably not a lot of disc golf. I think I'm gonna be taking a break from that this week.
Yeah, there you go. You want to injure your arm, tear your rotator cuff? You might have to get Tommy John or something like that.
Exactly.
Be out of commission. So take it easy. Hope everybody else takes it easy as well. For you Elite members, we'll be talking to you again on Friday. For everybody else, be safe out there, folks. We'll speak to you again on Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.